4 years in Moscow, a conversation with former NPR correspondent Corey Flintoff. Longtime listeners of NPR will recognize the name and the voice of Corey Flintoff, who for 17 years anchored newscasts at the network. But Flintoff also served NPR as a foreign correspondent, including a four-year stint as bureau chief in Moscow. I'm Keith Shortall, and today we'll talk with Corey Flintoff about his career in journalism, which began in Alaska, and about his move to NPR, enabled by his coverage of an environmental disaster. We'll also talk about his experiences working in Russia, a country in which the press is under extreme pressure from the government, and about his take on U.S.-Russia relations under Trump and Putin, Russia's alleged interference in the 2016 U.S. elections, and other front-page stories. And as always, we want to hear from you. A conversation with NPR's Corey Flintoff. First, this news. From Maine Public Radio, I'm Keith Shortall, and this is Maine Calling. His voice is well known to listeners of National Public Radio. In recent years, he brought his insightful reports on the evolving relations with Vladimir Putin's Russia. Corey Flintoff had a long career in radio journalism. He covered not only developments in Russia, but also the wars in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Ukraine. He reported on the earthquake in Haiti and the revolution in Egypt and the revolution and civil war in Libya. After such a full and influential career, he retired earlier this year. Today, Corey Flintoff joins me in the studio to talk about his career, the state of present-day journalism, and to answer your questions about the U.S.-Russia relationship or whatever else might be on your mind. Corey Flintoff, thanks for being here.
Good morning, Keith. It's a real pleasure to be here.
And as always, we want to hear from you. The number is 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainpublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Let's start out at the very beginning. You are from Alaska,
right,
originally, and got your start in radio there. But it was really more out of from a set of personal circumstances than it was a career goal.
Oh, absolutely. I had no intention of being in radio and no idea how much fun it could be. I wanted actually to be a novelist, and I found myself in a very small town in southwestern Alaska. It's called Bethel. And as a matter of fact, there are people here in Portland who have are friends of mine from Bethel, so they know what that place is like. I found myself there. At the time I was there, it was a predominantly Yupik Eskimo area. There are 56 villages in this particular region that's at the mouth of the Yukon and the Kuskokwim River. So it's a really interesting place. The great thing about the place, though, was that I asked somebody when I first got there, what do you do for a job around here? And they said, oh, go over to the radio station. They always need somebody. So I did. And it turned out that the only qualification you needed for getting on the radio there was to be able to say the station identification in Yupik, because it was a bilingual radio station. And so I got somebody to coach me through it, and I got the job.
Yeah, and you can still do that today.
I can still do it. Ni chugni uchi, ni chugni sutkun, kyukemak mani mamtalethlami.
How many years ago was that you remembered that?
Let's see. That was in 1977, wow. As a matter of fact.
Wow. And you would agree that, while people listening right now who are fans of public radio would say, well, Maine is really dependent upon public radio, and we do very well here with a loyal audience. But you have said that Alaska, perhaps more than any other state, really is dependent upon public radio.
Well, largely because it's such a big state. It's a big area, and these villages and towns are very far flung. So, especially in the old days, it was really hard to communicate between communities and between the major cities in Alaska. And so public radio became very important as a way of unifying these sort of far-flung places around the state. There are 16 public radio stations in Alaska right now. And it was also a way for each of these individual areas to sort of preserve their culture. There are Indian, Native American cultures in the center of Alaska. There's an Inuit culture in the northern Arctic part. There's the Yupik culture in the southwest. All these cultures have their own languages and their own traditions and their own oral stories, and radio stations really help preserve all that.
And do you think that that experience, that first radio experience covering that diversity in a very different place, helped you later in your coverage of foreign countries?
Oh, absolutely it did. You know, I mean, the cross-cultural communication was the biggest lesson for me. Even though I came from Alaska myself, and I should have known better, and I didn't realize that people from different cultures have very different ways of perceiving things and very different ways of addressing one another. And for instance, as someone who is trying to learn to be a reporter in a largely Yupik Eskimo community, I made a lot of serious mistakes and blunders, and it took me quite a while to figure out. Fortunately, I had friends who sort of coached me through this, figure out why I was having trouble communicating with people. And it turned out that there are a lot of basic courtesies and basic approaches to people that I wasn't following. You know, one of the most simple things is that in Yupik culture, a younger person never looks an elder person in the eye when speaking to them. It's considered sort of aggressive and disrespectful. You know, so I wondered why these elder people that I was interviewing kind of shied away from me when I spoke to them, you know. And it was when I found out, of course, I was tremendously embarrassed, but it really did help me understand that you have to approach people with respect and patience and a willingness to learn what their ways are.
Did you notice that when you stopped looking them in the eye, the interviews went better?
Absolutely. Or, yeah. You know, and it's proven out in ordinary daily life here in America. My wife and I have our best conversations sometimes when we're driving around in the car. You know, you're looking at something else you're required to. And so you're communicating only through voice, which is also the way radio works.
So you're in the small place in Bethel, and then eventually, though, you move to the big city, Anchorage?
Right, the big city was Anchorage, yes. And so I became part of the Alaska Public Radio Network. You know, the radio network's much the same way as it does here in Maine. And, you know, my big opportunity then was to do statewide news and political news and things like that.
How did you then get from Anchorage to NPR?
Well, it's a dirty little secret, you know, that every reporter, I suppose, has a disaster or a catastrophe of some sort in their background that bumps them up to the next job. And in my case, it was the 1989 Exxon Valdez oil spill. When that happened, you know, at the time it was the biggest oil spill in North America. It was enormous news, and it was something that NPR covered very thoroughly. So I got an opportunity to do a lot of reporting for NPR then. And that led me to, I got an invitation from NPR to take part in a residency program in D.C. And having done that, I was actually filled in for an overnight editor on the morning edition show. And, you know, it was very daunting to me at first to work in Washington and to work for my dream organization, which is NPR. But, you know, when you get to a place and you find that, you know, the nuts and bolts of doing it, you realize, I can do this, you know. So I came down and applied for a job.
Yeah. Many people recognize your voice and would say, oh, it's such a great voice for the newscast, which you did for 17 years.
That's right.
Did someone say, hey, he'd be good on the anchor desk, or how did you get there?
No, it happened that they needed a weekend fill-in person on the weekend newscasts. And you know, as you know, NPR really doesn't seek out the big, deep, resonant announcer voice. You know, it's part of our mission, in fact, that we try to reflect the voices of America. So, which is why you hear a lot of different accents and different pitches and that sort of thing among the voices on NPR. But so I fell into this job, and of course I found that very daunting too, to do that kind of on-air stuff, because frankly I flub a lot when I'm on the air. It was something that even in 17 years I never quite managed to overcome.
But you were very forgiving of yourself.
Absolutely, so that's the only way to do it.
Yeah, this of course must have been a very sitting in the anchor desk, a very different experience than the foreign correspondent jobs that you did later. But was it satisfying still?
It was. Yeah. You know, yes, because you get the great thing about being a news anchor is that you get to report on everything. You know, foreign news, domestic news, political, economic stuff. You can bring in cultural and arts features if you've got time. If you can do it in 30 to 40 seconds, you can put it on your newscast.
And you know you've made it when The Onion does a parody piece on you, which they did in 2003, and we can't repeat it because it's not something you can repeat on the air.
That's absolutely untrue. That may have been the beginning of fake news. I'm not sure.
I'm curious. We were talking about this. Every anchor that I've ever known, every reporter has that tape from their first or second air check that they did that's mm-hmm. awful, that they keep in the drawer just for fun. Do you have one of those, or did you always sound like you do now?
No. I was terrible when I first got on the air, and I may have to have that tape yet, but it's packed away somewhere where likely my heirs will find it someday.
That's funny. So the foreign correspondent gigs that came up for you. Did you decide at some point, I'd like to go do something else and use my talents? How did that happen?
Well, it wasn't a question of my talents, but I really have always liked to travel. So about the time of the invasion of Iraq, I started requesting overseas assignments. And NPR is quite good about that. I mean, if it works out, they will grant you a leave from your newscasting job or whatever and allow you to take a shot at doing overseas reporting. And so I pestered them enough and, was turned away enough times that I finally got to fill in for a couple of very fine correspondents at NPR who were going on maternity leave. That was Mary Louise Kelly and Michelle Kellerman. And so that was my opportunity both to do foreign affairs reporting and also to take some opportunities to go overseas.
Was it sort of an audition in terms of whether NPR would let you do more?
It was, as a matter of fact. And to tell you the truth, I didn't do terribly well. And one of the reasons for this, the first one I did was Mary Louise Kelly, who is then, as she is now, a national security correspondent. And she had spent 2 years building a network of sources in the intelligence agencies and the CIA and the NSA and the FBI also. And it had been a very laborious process because she had to win the trust of all these people. And she'd been quite successful at it. So she gave me virtually her entire Rolodex of all these names. But I was nobody to these folks, and they were not going to give me scoops about the intelligence community,
right?
Because they didn't know me yet. So that was a very tough one.
You would just say, "I'm a friend of
Mary Louise Kelly," which would get you a long way, but it won't get you that far.
Eventually, you do get this gig in Moscow.
Yes.
But there was a choice. It was unclear where you would go before that.
Well, as a matter of fact, after filling in for Mary Louise and Michelle Kellerman, I did start to get rotations in Iraq. We would go over to Baghdad for 30 days at a time and embed with the troops and that kind of thing. And I did that about 9 times. I started doing Afghanistan as well and doing a similar thing there. And when I was in Afghanistan, my boss said, well, we need somebody down in New Delhi to fill in for about 30 days. If you would go down there, that would be great. So I did that. And, of course, I loved India. And there was an opportunity to fill in for someone who's had a family health problem. And the idea was that they would rotate NPR reporters in and out of there over a course of 9 months or so. And once I got my foot in the door, I was the first one to go. I kept insisting that, I'm just getting up to speed here. I wouldn't want to waste what I've learned. I could be more valuable to you if I just stayed a little longer. So the result was that we got to stay there, my wife and I, for about 2 years.
When you got to Moscow, what was your initial impression of the place and the task before you?
I got there in the winter of 2012, which was just when these, if you remember, these enormous anti-government demonstrations were taking place. And it was really unprecedented. You know, tens of thousands of people out in the streets in Moscow and St. Petersburg. And they were largely middle-class, ordinary Russians, but, you know, well-educated and, you know, politically aware Russians. And they were really angry about Vladimir Putin's decision to come back to the presidency. You know, the way they announced it was he announced that he was going to take the seat back from Dmitry Medvedev. And it was done in a kind of an arrogant, heavy-handed way. And people were really angry about that. And they were also really angry about a parliamentary election that was clearly and blatantly rigged. So that brought all these people out into the streets. And I arrived at a time of great optimism and sort of great fervor in the population. So it was a very exciting place to start
and,
out.
And people were willing to talk to you freely.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. They were eager to talk to a foreign reporter.
What was it like trying to reach a government official or get a response from a government official?
Well, it was difficult even then, but it was a little easier. It became worse as time went on. I was there for a little over 4 years, and year by year, it frankly became more and more difficult to talk to government officials. And, of course, they never reject you outright. They always say, well, we need to see what the schedule looks like, and we need to talk to our bosses, and we need to do this and that. The object of all that is just to stall you until you get past your deadline and the interview is no longer of any use to you.
And that happens here, too. But so over the course of time, you were watching Putin's sort of solidify his power.
Exactly.
And he kind of drained his own swamp, I guess, in some way. He purged some of the people
That's right.
with whom he had come to power.
Absolutely. You know, when I first got to Moscow, sort of foreign analysts were putting out these charts and graphs showing how power devolved throughout the Kremlin, with Putin always at the center, of course, and then various factions. You know, there was a security faction called the Siloviki, the men of power, and there was an economic faction that was dominated by economic liberals and so forth. So there was a back and forth in the government, and Putin was considered to be the mediator and the balancer of all his interests. Well, in the course of the 4 years that I was there, he eliminated so many of the people who were in the inner circles of Kremlin power, people that, as you say, he had come up with from the KGB and the FSB, which was the successor security agency. He eliminated them. He farmed them out into various jobs. Many of them became very rich during their time in government, so being eased out was not such a painful thing. Right. But the result was that he's now replaced a lot of those people with young technocrats who worked for him for his entire time in power and are totally loyal to him. He's surrounded by yes men. He doesn't have very many no men left.
And we'll talk about what he has done to the press in mm-hmm. Russia. But first, we're going to take a quick break, and we'll take your calls as well. The number, 1-800-399-3566. We're talking with Corey Flintoff. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does the law firm of Eaton Peabody. Statewide practice, local service, with offices in Augusta, Bangor, Brunswick, Ellsworth, and Portland.
As your NPR station, we keep you in touch with what's happening every day. And with so much at stake, you're counting on Maine Public Radio perhaps more than ever. And listener support is as important as ever to keep this vibrant journalism strong and independent. Hi, this is Mark Vogelsang, president of Maine Public, urging you to do your part with a regular contribution during our one-day Super Thursday on-air fundraising campaign. We're bringing you more programming than we ever have, but keeping our on-air campaign short and sweet. And of course, you can pledge securely online today at mainpublic.org.
More than 300 million photographs are uploaded to Facebook every single day. Pictures of tasty meals and smiling families, pictures of pretty views from the front porch.
If you looked only from the porch, you could see mountains. But if you looked to the left, you could see this huge factory. But of course, I didn't take pictures of the factory, because why would you do that?
The lives and the lies we perpetuate online on the next Hidden Brain from NPR.
Join us for Hidden Brain Sunday morning at 11 on Maine Public Radio.
And welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Keith Shortle. Today on the program, longtime NPR international correspondent Corey Flintoff. He was NPR's Moscow bureau chief for 4 years. We invite you to join the conversation. The number is 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainpublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. So you arrived in Russia. There were these demonstrations going on, and Putin was consolidating his power and eliminating some around him, what he'd come to power with, and replacing them with these young technocrats, as you said. He was also moving against the press.
Yes, absolutely. And not only the press, but also civil society organizations, independent think tanks and policy groups that were, even if not directly opposed to the government, were independent enough to be suspicious in his mind. So what he did with the news media was to take a lot of news channels under government control. So there are a number of state-run news channels in Russia that all echo the same party line, basically. And there are a couple of nominally independent stations that are actually owned by Kremlin-friendly oligarchs. You know, so they maintain the party line as well. A couple of independent stations have been closed. Various other independent media have been co-opted in one way or another. And at this point, there are only a couple of news outlets in Russia that are absolutely independent. There's a radio station in Moscow called Echo Moskvy. It doesn't have a very wide broadcast area, but it is has a good presence online. There's a couple of newspapers and magazines that are still independent, but they have very small circulations. And there are independent Russian journalists who've basically been forced to leave the country and set up online news operations in other countries. And there's one in Latvia, in Riga, called Medusa, that has an English language feed. And if you want to check it out, it's medusa.com. And it's quite interesting.
He also, the government also purchased or bought up entities, as you said.
Yes.
Yes.
That's absolutely right.
So at what risk are these independent journalists? I mean, how serious is the risk to those who are remaining and working in the country?
It's very serious indeed. And I mean, just in the last couple of weeks, we've had one of the more vocal independent journalists, a woman by the name of Yulia Latinina, who just left the country saying that it was no longer possible for her to work safely in Russia. But this is a pattern that's been repeated over and over and over again. And worse yet, you know, there are, as you probably know, there are a lot of journalists have been killed in Russia. I saw somewhere, I think since 1993, it's something in excess of 50 reporters have been killed one way or another.
What was your experience? Did the government put pressure on you either before or after a story?
No, actually, very little pressure, and very little attention is paid really to most foreign correspondents in Moscow. And the reason for that is that the government has very little to fear from us. You know, the NPR does not broadcast in Russia, of course, and we do our news reporting is all done in English. So that eliminates a lot of the Russian domestic audience from hearing any of the things that I produced. And the other is that, you know, although NPR is available online, you know, most Russians don't use foreign language media online. So the Russian government feels pretty safe. And in fact, I did have the latitude to move around quite freely. I could pretty much interview anyone who was willing to talk to me. And, you know, so I didn't have a lot of restrictions. The Ministry of Foreign Affairs actually manages all the foreign correspondents in Russia, and they actually have control over whether or not you get a visa. And your visa is renewed, you know, from year to year. So if they wanted to, they could always pull your visa and prevent you from coming back. And that did happen to a couple of my fellow correspondents while I was there.
Also, there were a couple of guys who followed you around for a while.
this did not happen to me very much. You know, we always assumed that our computers were hacked and that our phones could be listened to. Question was whether anybody was really bothering to listen to us or not, and I doubt seriously that they paid an awful lot of attention. But periodically, when you go to places in the provinces and let them know that you were coming, you would find yourself the subject of scrutiny. And this happened in Kaliningrad, which is an exclave. You know, it's a piece of territory that's between Poland and Lithuania. But it belongs to Russia, and for Russia, it's a very important Baltic seaport and also a military installation. So they're very nervous about having foreign correspondents there, and I got there with my Russian producer, and from the very moment we arrived, we had a couple of guys following us around. Same guys. They looked like sort of middle-aged Abbott and Costello types, And we would catch them from time to time. Once we made a wrong turn on a bridge and discovered that we were wrong, we turned around, and here's these two standing right behind us.
So they had to look busy.
Oh, they did. They pulled out their cell phones. But
that's interesting. You had to tell the local authorities that you were coming, right? You couldn't just show up.
Well, we didn't have to, but in that case, I wanted to interview local authorities. Yeah. And, of course, they, like everybody else, were not willing to talk to me.
Yeah. Let's take a call, and then we'll get to some of the stories that are in the news and get your take on that. We'll go to Louis in Bangor. Hi, Louis. Welcome to the program.
Hi.
All right, go ahead, please.
Thank you. Mr. Flintoff, first of all, thank you very much for your fine work over the years. I like so many people, am a great fan of public radio, and you have been a wonderful addition to that. Sorry to see you go, but as a recent retiree, I suggest you enjoy it. It'll be great.
Thank you.
Okay, question for you. I have always wondered why folks like you, and I'll show my age here. Harry Reasoner was the first person that caused this thought to occur to me, who are so liberally and eclectically educated with issues and culture nationally, internationally. Why don't you folks run for public office? No one is more qualified. Now, maybe the answer is because you're too smart to get into the fray, but I've been curious about that.
Well, we have an example here, Corey, where Angus King, the senator, mm-hmm. was a longtime host of our weekly TV public affairs show on this very station, on the main public television. That's how he got his name recognition. But anyway, I'll let you answer Louis's question.
You know, I think that there's a whole difference between observing and reporting on something and being an activist, an activist politician. I mean, speaking of politicians in the very best sense, you know, the people who do the public's business, I admire a lot of politicians and I admire the work that they do, but I'm not particularly interested in getting into that part of the trench. I'm much more interested in learning about the issues and telling other people about them.
So that's clearly not on your radar for the next 10 years, I guess.
No, but thank you, Louis.
Right. Let's go to Jay in Sedgwick. Hi, Jay. Welcome to the program.
Well, thank you. First of all, I am a former on-air person there at Maine Public, and it's good to hear you again. Corey, I have to say, when I was trying to lose my Minnesota accent, you are one of the voices that I studied to try to get that non-Western accent, and I think it paid off, but that's not what I'm calling about. I wanted to know if you have any observations as to how the Russian people look back at the Bolshevik Revolution, which was 100 years ago this year, and the October Revolution 100 years ago this month. What the average Russian, how they view that, since it's not a communist country anymore. So I'll hang up and listen, and best of luck to you. Thanks.
Thank you, Jay.
That's a really interesting question, and it's interesting because of the way the Russian government is playing the revolution. You know, the Russian government uses historical events and anniversaries in a lot of different ways. And for instance, the anniversary of victory in World War II, the Great Patriotic War, was something that was played up enormously. And it was something that was designed to influence unity, you know, to bring about unity among the Russian people and a sense of patriotism and a willingness to sacrifice. Well, they're a lot more ambivalent about the events in 1917. And, you know, because obviously that was the time that the communists overthrew. Well, that was the time that revolutionaries overthrew the Tsar and that the Bolsheviks in turn seized power and started the Soviet Empire, basically. So the Putin regime does not particularly like revolutions. It does not like revolutions to be romanticized or glorified in any way. And it's also true that the Putin regime has drifted back towards many of the sort of values and traditions that were part of Imperial Russia, you know, that were part of the Tsarist times. There's been a resurgence in the Russian Orthodox Church. There's been a great deal of interest paid to the Russian royal family. You know, for instance, there was a big documentary series a couple of years ago in Russia on the history of the Romanovs, you know, a 300-year dynasty in Russia. And all these things are presented as something that are part of the glories of Russia's past. So the revolution itself then becomes a very problematic kind of a thing. And in fact, I was talking to a Russian journalist just a couple of weeks ago, and he said, you know, what's happened is that the Russian Civil War is finally over and the whites won. And what he meant about that, I mean, if you know the Russian Civil War was between the Reds, the Bolsheviks, and the whites, who were monarchist Russians, you know, who wanted to restore the monarchy. In a way, what's happened, that Civil War was over in the early 1920s, and the Soviets won. But in my friend's mind, what happened is that really the same values that kind of infused Imperial Russia are the ones that have won out under Vladimir Putin.
Who is more king-like than...
Exactly.
Yeah. Let's talk about what's going on today. So we just witnessed this great turnabout in U.S.-Russian relations. During the 2016 election, this unusual... warmth being expressed mm-hmm. between candidate Trump and Putin, which we were trying to understand, and then after he becomes president, this great turnaround, and now one report describes U.S.-Russian relations as an accident waiting to happen. What's your take on this great turnaround?
I think, you know, what was happening during the campaign, and this is completely aside from any issue of collusion, I think that Vladimir Putin's great desire and goal was the elimination of the sanctions against Russia, and especially the financial sanctions, because those do bite very deeply into the Russian economy, and especially into the financial activities of Putin and the people in his inner circle. So it's a very serious thing for them. That's probably what he wants most of all from a relationship with the United States. And he thought he was going to get it from Donald Trump. And he also thought that he was going to get some kind of validation of his territorial claims in Ukraine. And that I think that proved to be a great disappointment to him when he found that Trump was unable to get these sanctions lifted or has not done anything serious to get them lifted. And he actually showed a fit of pique. You know, for a while he was being sort of complimentary of Trump as president, you know, and the Russian news media were being very pro-Trump and showing a lot of interest in his administration. But that turned around when the sanctions were not lifted. And I think the fact that Putin, for instance, expelled so many workers and diplomats from the U.S. embassy in Moscow, you know, something in excess of 500 people were kicked out, is a sign that he doesn't see any immediate hope for an improvement in U.S.-Russian relations anytime in the near future. And he's kind of given up on it for the moment.
All right. We'll talk more about this after another quick break. First, though, also a word about Monday's show. We'll talk about the latest on Maine's marijuana regulations. The two legislators who led the joint committee charged with formulating rules on marijuana use will join us to explain those rules. You can email your comments or questions to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet us, or post to our Facebook page. And after the break, give us a call and you can talk to Corey Flintoff, the number 1-800-399-3566. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do the Goldfarb Center for Public Affairs at Colby College, inspiring active citizenship in the world of public affairs, and MEMIC, a workers' compensation insurance company dedicated to safer workplaces, fair treatment for all workers, and a strong Maine economy, on the web at MEMIC.com.
Hundreds of cities put in bids to be the second headquarters for Amazon, including 26 separate bids in Massachusetts.
We have long believed that providing lots of options is a winning strategy.
Meanwhile, what's New Hampshire's pitch?
All the benefits of Boston without the headaches.
On Next from the New England News Collaborative, a cross-border battle for jobs. I hope you can join us.
Join us for Next at 2 o'clock in about 20 minutes following Maine Calling, right here on Maine Public Radio. It takes just one day for Maine Public Radio to conduct its fall fundraiser. One day to do all the business that needs to be done, unlike other parts of the country. That's thanks to listeners like you who step up and do your part. Our Fall Super Thursday is November 2nd. And think about it. Imagine a full week of preempting your favorite valued programming at this time of year with so much important news each day. That's something we should avoid at all costs, and we know you agree. So please do your part on our one-day fundraiser, Super Thursday, or right now. Contributions will count toward those goals. You can visit mainepublic.org or call 800-866-1475. And thank you.
Welcome back. I'm Keith Shortall. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today, joining me in the studio, NPR international correspondent Corey Flintoff, who spent a long career covering some of the major news events across the world. Join the conversation. Give us a call. The number is 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. How much was known or reported about Donald Trump's interest, visits, connections to Russia in those years before the election, before it was known he might be a candidate?
Actually, there was quite a bit, you know, and I mean, the sort of premier event was the Miss Universe contest in Moscow, and there was a lot of attention paid to that, actually. But as part of that, there was also a lot of talk in Russian media about Trump's interest in doing business in Russia. And there's another purpose behind that, too. One of Russia's big problems right now is an inability to get foreign investment. And that's because the investment climate in Russia is not good. You won't be, your contracts are not well protected. The judiciary is not very independent and thus not trustworthy for foreign business people. So by using Trump as a kind of a poster child for this, you know, an idea, oh, American billionaire has an enormous interest in building Trump Towers and so forth throughout Russia. That was something that was of a great deal of interest to the Russian media at the time. But there was nothing, for instance, about these deals or purported deals that that eventually fell through, because evidently there were quite a number of them and nothing got off the ground.
Because of the system of bribery on which doing business in Russia depends, is my understanding. So he was being used as a poster child, or an example that it could be done.
Yes.
But he would not be up against the same challenges, would he, at that level, in terms of corruption or bribery? Or would he, do you think?
It's very hard to say. But let me put it this way. One of the biggest problems for Russia is capital outflow. That is to say that money that's made in Russia is not reinvested there. It's shipped out of the country. And I looked this up, actually. In the year 2008, which happened to be the year that Donald Trump Jr. gave an interview saying, you know, we're getting a tremendous amount of money, investment money, pouring in from Russia. During that year, The capital outflow was $137 billion. And that's just money that went through the banking systems. That doesn't count money that was carried out of the country in suitcases. So, you know, this tremendous capital outflow had to find a place to locate itself, and it wound up in places like London and New York and Cyprus and the Bahamas, you know, and that sort of thing. It wound up being invested in New York and London real estate, you know. So that's part of that's an important part of the Trump-Russia connection. The Trump said that they had received a lot of investment from Russia. It said that in the condominium developments on the coast of Florida, that Russian was heard almost more often than English because so many Russians were hiding their money in American real estate investments.
You've described Russia as essentially a criminal, the government as a criminal enterprise, and that's not an overstatement or an exaggeration.
You know, when I got there, I didn't believe that. I was told that by people, but I didn't believe it. So I have been a convert to having seen so many of these reports of these deals and talked to people who in some way or another were connected with these kinds of dealings. And lately, you know, the Russian opposition has been doing exposés on the internet. And what they've done essentially is identify how many Russian officials have enormous assets, palatial mansions, yachts, villas in Italy that are completely unexplainable in terms of their government salaries or their salary histories anywhere. In other words, you know, billions and billions of dollars have been drained out of the Russian economy, and they're going into the pockets of Russian officials.
I read in one interview you likened it to the mafia in some ways.
Well, yeah. I mean, if the pattern of a mafia family is that there's one person at the top, there's a small coterie of ruling people at the top, and then a pyramid of soldiers that goes all the way down to the very lowest level. Everybody is required to pay a percentage of whatever they're doing. And a certain amount of criminal activity is actually encouraged by the leadership because not only is it profitable, not only are we taking a percentage from all this activity, but it means that we know that you are culpable and thus vulnerable. And if you get out of line, it means that we can take what we know about your criminal activities and use it against you. And periodically this happens in Russia. You know, officials who get out of line are suddenly prosecuted for their crimes.
Yeah. Obviously, the hacking story is a big and ongoing story. This is multiple investigations going on into whether the Russians directly influenced the 2016 elections here. But in your coverage of news for 4 years, there's no question in your mind that they have influenced elections.
Yes, although, you know, I'm basing the direct influence, you know, on the word of the various United States intelligence agencies, because we didn't have a clear sense of this when we were actually in Russia. Of course, you're not hearing about it on Russian media or anything like that. But it started to become a story as I was about to leave, pretty much in the final year that I was there, that they were discovering especially Russian opposition people were discovering these organized hacking operations in Russia and reporting on them. And it was clear, you know, it's always known that, you know, I mean, Russia is during the Soviet Union had a tremendously well-educated population, and a great deal of that education and especially ability in the cybersphere has filtered down. And some of it obviously went to the dark side. And of course, we know about Russian hackers' involvement in international theft from banks and businesses. But there's a lot of hacking talent in Russia. And so it comes as no surprise that the government was using it. And one thing that I think we've discovered is that the Russian government was really prescient, you know, really ahead of the curve in learning how to experiment with this and how to use it effectively.
And you tell a story about an operation in your neighborhood. In fact,
that's right. That actually was a troll farm. I don't know whether they were involved in hacking or not, but that was something else. Yes, there was an office building in my neighborhood, just around the corner from my apartment, as a matter of fact. And one day, like a mushroom, this business sprang up, and you could look through the windows and you could see rows and rows of young people in their cubicles with their computers and their headphones on, working away, you know, in two shifts. And so we couldn't figure out what this was. And of course, there were no signs on the door to tell you what sort of business this was. And we later found out that it was a troll farm.
And explain what a troll farm is.
Right. Well, so a troll is, you know, somebody who influences social media, you know, and usually in a dark way, usually in a negative way. And the way Russia uses trolls is to have them get on social media, and especially on comment threads and things like that, to push a pro-Russian line in one way or another, either to or let's say a disruptive line. And that's especially true of the United States. Apparently, it appears that they were attempting to create division and disrupt things here.
We've only got literally a couple minutes left here, but we'll bring in Andrew. Andrew, quickly, welcome to the program. What's your question?
Hi. I have a question. I want to know your thoughts on this. Is a probably a majority of Americans don't know about this. I want to know your thoughts on the National Bolshevik Party of Russia, aka the Nazbol Party.
Frankly, I don't know very much about them, Andrew. You know, there are remnants of the Communist Party in various ways, and some of those have gone to become nationalist parties, almost national socialist parties. So there's a joining of the most extreme right and most extreme left, and there are a number of small parties now that sort of espouse that kind of ideology. I don't think that they're terribly important, and I don't think they're going to be terribly influential.
Andrew, thank you. Final thoughts on the future of Russia, near future. You can play a pundit here, not reporter, but where does this criminal enterprise going? Do we see Putin in power for the near future?
I do, barring some natural calamity. I don't see that his tenure as president is threatened in any way. He controls the levers of power so effectively and so thoroughly, he's going to be very hard to get rid of. We know that we need to work with Russia on a number of things, including things like nuclear nonproliferation. But we also need, I think, to be very cautious. And in my mind, Russia under Putin is an adversary of the United States, and we need to be cautious about that.
And complicating this is North Korea.
Absolutely.
Which is another unknown factor going on here. So it's...
Right. It's like, you know, North Korea is sort of the mini-me of the relationship with Russia, except it's much more extreme.
Right. Corey, thank you very much.
Thank you, Keith.
Very interesting. Corey Flintoff, a public radio journalist for some 40 years, most recently as NPR's Moscow bureau chief. Roddy Nickpour ran the board today, and you can find past editions of Maine Calling, as well as a link to our audio archives by visiting mainecalling.org. Today's show will be rebroadcast again tonight at 7 o'clock. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Monday on the program, we'll learn about the latest on Maine's marijuana regulations. I'm Keith Shortall. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.